Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Hey everybody, welcome to ANCAST. I'm Zach Birchie. It's good to be back. A very special guest this week. He's the ADR director of the original Sailor Moon dub from way back in the day, and he's got a new book out called Sailor Moon Reflections, the inside story of the original recordings of the English version of Sailor Moon. It's Roland Parliament. Roland, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. In fact, it's an honor to be with you.
All right. So let's start from the beginning. Now, obviously, the book is about Sailor Moon, but I'm curious about your career before you encountered Sailor Moon. What, obviously, you were involved in the entertainment industry in some way before working on this show. So what were the early days like for you?
Well, actually, I started out as a musician. I was a guitar player, and I played in several bands through my teen years and early 20s. The band went full time, I was playing at a bar in North Bay. And we went to see an afternoon matinee of another band, and I noticed the guitar player at the time was about 50 years of age. He obviously had a severe alcohol problem. He had kids he hadn't seen in years. And I thought about that and said, I don't want to end up like that.
Uh-huh.
I'm a good guitar player, but I'm not any kind of virtuoso. So I quit. Then I went to work for an advertising agency for 3.5 years. And I quit that because, it was boring.
Right.
I get bored very easily. And then I thought, well, I've got something of an advertising background and something of a music background, so let me start a jingle company. But I was too young and stupid to realize that it couldn't possibly work, so it did. And my first client was the Royal Bank of Canada, for which I wrote a jingle called For a Lot of Reasons. And during the production, I was singing on the original version of this, and during the production, the agency came to me and said, do you think you could do voiceovers? Because it would be nice if the singer and the voiceover were the same. And I said, yeah, sure, how hard could it be? Well, I didn't realize how much technique was involved, so it took me, quite some time to learn how to do this properly.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I had probably done, 1,000 voiceover commercials, and I wanted to do more with my voice. So I thought, well, what else is there? And I thought, well, animation. So I went to all kinds of auditions, and the answer was usually the same. No, you don't have enough experience, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, in 1995, I auditioned for a series called Sailor Moon. And initially, I didn't hear anything back. And then finally, the initial audition was in February. Finally, in July, I heard back, and they said, well, we're still missing one character, the character of Melvin. He's a nerd. Can you do a nerd? And I went, yeah. That was my childhood. I was a nerd. So I auditioned for it, and I got the part. And then shortly thereafter, there was a problem with the existing director, Tracy Moore. She had conflicting contracts, so she had to leave, and they asked me if I could take over as director, given my experience directing commercials. So I did, and, you know, I directed the next 65 episodes. And I'm so glad I did, you know, because it was a killer thing to do, but it was so rewarding. It introduced me to so many fabulous talents, and, I learned so much from those people, you know. So, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, so initially, coming from an advertising background and a musician background, obviously, like, anime had not really been on your radar, and so the show must have seemed strange to you. What was your original, like, reaction to Sailor Moon, like, just as a television show?
Well, when I first walked into the studio and saw the animation, I thought, I don't know if I really like this, because it was so different from what I was used to seeing, which was, you know, Hanna-Barbera, Walter Lantz, Warner Brothers, you know, Bugs Bunny, all those type of cartoons. But the further we got into the production of the series, the more I realized, you know, this is something really interesting. And I did some research on this, and I found out that the Japanese animators had studied the Disney technique, but they had customized it into their own. And also, the story was so deep, going back centuries, and, that fascinated me. So as the series progressed, I got more and more into it, and eventually ended up loving it.
Right.
Even though it was my first experience with anime.
Right, right. And so, in the early days, when they first brought you on as director, were you, at that point, had the show been completely cast, and you were working with an already established group of players, or were you allowed to either make casting decisions or changes as you saw fit?
Well, mostly so. It was cast, but when Tracy Moore left, because she was director and she was also Sailor Moon, then we brought in Terry Hawks, who, in my estimation, was the best of them all. There are not enough good things I can say about Terry Hawks. She's the ultimate professional. She is, a kind, decent person. Also, a fabulous performer in many capacities as an on-screen actor and as voiceover person as well. There were replacements along the way. Tuxedo Mask, which was originally done by Romo Romano, was replaced by Toby Proctor. And then, of course, there was always the monster of the day that we had to cast along the way. So there was, a lot of additions to the cast, and then, new characters were introduced, and I forget the Alan was the male character's name, and they were two former students of mine from Ryerson University, Vince Carrera and Sabrina Gertovich, and they took over those roles as well. So, there was a lot of changes, and a lot of new people brought in.
So, right, and what was the environment like back then in terms of producing a show for television? Now, obviously, this is a Canadian production, so the rules there are different than, they are here in the States. But back then, in the 90s, producing children's television was, I would imagine, totally different from what it's like now, and definitely when it comes to localizing an existing Japanese television show. How much freedom did you have? Like, what was the scripting process like?
Well, the script writers got a rough translation from the Japanese. Now, keep in mind that in Japan, this was not a children's show. this was prime time, and there was a lot more, can I say, nudity and violence in the original show. But in North America, they had to tone the whole thing down for the conservative North American market. So there were a lot of changes that I know that dedicated fans who are aware of the Japanese series weren't very happy about, because they said, well, you changed the whole plot of the thing. But, you know, that was necessary to get it by the censors in North America. So, you know, and that was one of the reasons for the Sailor Says segment, which started off everything, because they were trying to turn it into a kids' television show and to give every episode a moral.
Right.
So there were extreme changes from the original Japanese series. Again, necessitated by the censorship rules in North America.
Right, right. And but back then, I mean, so you were more beholden to the television censors than you were to, say, like, you know, the Japanese. Like, you weren't necessarily answering directly to Toei. You were talking, your chief concern was standards and practices there in Canada.
Yeah, and the series was licensed from Toei by Deke Animation,
right,
in Burbank, California. So those were the people we answered to. And interestingly, one of the jokes around the studio was Deke stood for do it cheap, do it in Canada.
Right.
So those were the people that we answered to. And, you know, they determined what the content would be. They had to approve all the scripts and so on.
Okay, so you're effectively just doing what they say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm an employee.
Right.
You know, or was an employee. You know, I was hired to direct and to do some acting in the series, and that was it. So, yeah, there were some miscellaneous script changes that I made along the way, you know, because of, well, for example, Terry Hawks had a problem with the word ladies, which she thought was sexist. So we had to change that to women. And, you know, there is a few small things along the way, but basically we stuck to the scripts that were supplied to us and approved by Deke.
Right, okay. And so what was the schedule like? Because you're doing 65 episodes of this, I assume, in a syndication block, right? So this isn't like for Saturday mornings. This is for just to be stripped in the afternoons.
And it was hell. To be quite honest, it was hell. You know, when I first took on the directing assignment, you know, I thought, well, you know, how hard can this be? My workday started at 9 o'clock and ended usually the next day at 1 the next morning.
Oof.
And, you know, with television, things happen very quickly. So you got to keep pace. And at one point, we were exactly 1 week behind the broadcast schedule. So then we really poured on the pressure. So it was a very, very difficult schedule for all of us. You know, and to be quite honest with you, when I finished, I think we finished, wrapped up around November the 3rd, you know, I had been working those multi-hour days, day in, day out, weekends, with a very rare day off. And I got pretty sick, you know, because I was just worn out from the experience. But I don't regret it, because I learned so much, and I paid my dues.
Right. Well, I would imagine you would learn a lot dubbing. So you managed to complete a 65-episode block of shows in how much time, approximately?
Well, we started July the 10th, and we finished on November the 3rd.
Oh, man. Wow.
Yeah, no, we flew.
That's ridiculous.
and I really have to credit the cast and the crew for that. that we were able to accomplish that. You know, people walked in there, they'd never seen the scene before, they didn't have a script beforehand, and they watched the scene once, and then they just did it. And usually they got it right the first time, because they're very professional,
right?
You know,
yeah.
And very experienced actors. So it was a joy to work with such an astonishing cast of performers.
What do you have any favorite stories from your time? You know, during the recording sessions, do you have any especially funny or fond memories of the recording sessions?
Oh, there are many, many of them. One that I recall in particular was when Neflight died, which is fairly early on in the series, and Mary Long played Molly, who was Neflight's girlfriend, and Mary came into the studio. She looked at the scene once and said, "Let's roll it," and she did a performance with such unbelievable sorrow, crying. It was just astonishing. There wasn't a dry eye in the control room after her performance. It was just stunning. Another thing that sticks out in my mind was, early autumn. I was sitting in the coffee room, and I'd been staring at a TV monitor for 12 hours, so my brain was mush.
Mm-hmm.
And on this one occasion, and I think this only happened once, was that all the Sailor Scouts were there at the same time. And they were walking towards me as I was sitting on the couch, and my brain did some sort of flip where I went into another world, and what I saw walking towards me were the actual Sailor Scouts. And they were all marching with a purpose, although their purpose in this case was not to save the universe, but to perform their parts. But in that one moment, because they all looked very much like their characters at the time, at that one moment, I was just astonished at what I was seeing. And it was a magic moment that I'll never forget.
Wow. Any stories from that time that, you know, particular frustrations either with Deke or with standards and practices, like just anything that really stuck out as just like, this was a big sticking point for you?
There were some occasions that were frustrating. We were working very late one evening, and I had a performer in there who was doing a monster. And for some reason, she just wasn't sounding monsterish enough. And I tried everything I knew. I pulled out every trick in my bag. I did line reads for her, cajoled, pushed, but she just wasn't sounding evil. So I took a big chance, and I went into the studio, and I said something to her that made her really, really angry with me. Went back into the control room and said, "Okay, now let's do the scene." And then I got a monster because she was highly peed off.
Yeah, well, I would imagine in a high-pressure situation like that where the schedule is so grueling, you know, you wind up having to resort to stuff like that just to get through it.
Well, it's one of the dirtier jobs of being a director, but it comes with the job.
Right.
You know, your job is to get that performance out of that actor, and whatever you have to do that, you do that. And I remember back there was a movie with James Cagney in it, and he did one thing in one of the scenes. He was having breakfast with his girlfriend or his wife, and this was totally unscripted. But he was eating a grapefruit, and he took the grapefruit and smashed it into her face, and then got this reaction, you know, because this actress was so shocked that this had happened, you know. So, you know, you do things like that to create really interesting drama or comedy. I had always remembered that, you know, and reading about it afterwards in a biography about James Cagney, how this was unscripted, and, you know, he wanted to get a reaction from this actress that he wasn't getting, so he smashed the grapefruit in her face.
Okay. So you were also the voice of the character Melvin in the show, and so were you sort of directing yourself at that point? Did you have a pinch hitter come in and direct for you, or how did that work out?
I pretty much directed myself. Mm-hmm. We did have a couple of substitute directors. Mary Long directed some episodes. Terry Hawks directed some episodes, and these were usually times when I was just gone. You know, I was totally spent, and just couldn't carry on. Now I was getting some direction from my engineer, the great engineer Sal Grimaldi. Could you be a little bigger here or something like that? And also the producer Nicole Thiel. She offered some suggestions as well. Although Nicole's English isn't very good because she's Parisian French, so I sort of had to interpret, and sometimes asked her to give me the directions in French because I speak a little French, so that I understood what she was asking for. But I would say largely, yeah, I directed myself.
And how did you feel about the character? I mean, what was your take on him?
I love that guy. he reminded me so much of myself in my childhood before I became a musician, when I was a nerd. Mm-hmm. I was a bookworm. So I drew upon all of those things from my past to imbue into this character, but he's who I wished I could have been when I was a nerd, because he was brave beyond his means. In the episode Tuxedo Melvin, he took on a monster which he was surely unable to have any effect on at all, but he did it anyway. He was brave, Well, I guess, in a way, I was kind of brave. One of the things that bolstered my confidence was taking martial arts for 4 years, because I was getting real tired of getting beaten up in the schoolyard. Mm-hmm. So I decided, I'm going to learn how to fight. And I did. And, it's strange, but as soon as I started, training, I never had another fight. Because people didn't know what I was capable of doing, so they decided, I don't think we're going to test that, because he might break something really important of mine.
So let's talk a little bit about the legacy of the show itself on you personally. The show, it took a little while for it to become a big hit. It wasn't like a massive success overnight or anything. But then over time, like over, the last 20 years or so, it became this huge cultural touchstone for millions of people. Your version specifically was the most visible version for quite some time. Can you share any stories about your experience with the impact of the show and with the fans?
As soon as the thing started airing, which was early September of 95, we realized this has got a huge viewership. This isn't, some cheesy little cartoon. This is big. And that's when we started bringing cameras into the studio. So we photographed a lot of the performers in action, which are a lot of those photos are included in the book. And I guess the first time I really had a real understanding of what this meant was, I was invited by a friend of mine and an avid Sailor Moon friend whose name is Steve Mittler, to an anime convention at the University of Toronto, the group called UTARPA, the University of Toronto Role Playing Association, or something like that. And we snuck in, and there was another anime being shown on the screen at the time, so it was dark, and then we were escorted to our seats in the front row. Then the lights came up, and Steve stood up and said, you know, it gives me great pleasure to introduce the director of Sailor Moon Role in Parliament. And I stood up, and the crowd went nuts. And I went, what is this? Mm-hmm. And I'd also brought Stephanie Morgenstern along with me, who played Sailor Venus. And I then introduced her. Then they went really nuts.
Right, yeah.
you know, because she looked very much like her character. You know, petite, very pretty, blonde. And one of them said, can you give your Venus battle cry? And this moment stuck in my mind because I thought it was so quick-witted of Stephanie, because she said, I could, but it's so powerful, it will probably kill everybody in this room.
So it's however many years later now. It's 20 years later. And the show's having, like, a resurgence. It's coming back. And the show's getting a new dub. It's being redubbed to be, you know, more faithful to the original show. You know, no more Sailor Says. How do you feel about that? How does it make you feel?
I'm jealous. Because I think almost everybody in the cast has said at one time or another, if they asked me to do it again, I would. But nobody's asked us to do it again. And I believe that the new dub is being done in Dallas. I'm not sure about that.
No, it's in California, but yeah.
It's in California, okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'd all love to go back and revisit that, because that was a very special time in all of our lives. You know, it was really hard work. And at first we didn't realize, you know, exactly what we were doing. But then when we saw, you know, the mass appeal that the show had, it was like, wow, you know? And at the time, we didn't really think about how hard it was or, you know, am I doing this right or anything? You know, it was just, well, this, you know, this is work. You know, an actor needs to work. So, you know, we went to the studio every day and did our job and then went home. And then we realized, wow, this has had such an impact on people. And I teach at Niagara College in Welland, and a lot of my students were little kids at the time that this series was running. And as soon as they find out that I was the director of Sailor Moon, like, instant acceptance, you know. And one student at the beginning of last semester actually came up to me and said, is it true that you directed Sailor Moon? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, I want to thank you for making my childhood wonderful. You taught me so much about morals and about standards and about being confident. And I broke down in tears at that, you know, because it was just such a beautiful thing to hear and to realize that we had such impact on people still astounds me.
Well, yeah, I mean, the show is very special from that perspective. And not only that, it's unique from the perspective that it's a truly empowering show for young women, which almost still kind of doesn't really exist in the landscape of even syndicated programming. Like, it's still something special to have a show aimed at that audience that resonates with that audience, that doesn't pander to that audience or talk down to them. And
the only other show that comes to mind is Xena.
Yeah, right, sure.
You know, the warrior princess. But yeah, and Terry Hawks is, in the book, has mentioned that very, very specifically, because Terry is very much for women power. know, she's a feminist. And I thought, this is great, because I strongly believe in equal opportunity for equal talent. And that's not just limited to women. It's limited to people of race and color, beliefs, and so on. And I can't see any reason why these people should be denied work just because they're of a certain gender or of a certain belief or, you know, of a certain race. You know, it's, if you can do the job, doesn't matter who you are, you should get the job.
Right. Right. So are you, I mean, have you seen the new version? Have you taken a look at it?
I haven't seen it, no.
Oh, okay. All right. I was going to see what you thought, but okay. All right. So, well, we got some questions from your fans on Twitter here, and wanted to get through some of these. So, okay. You sort of answered this already, but maybe you've got another one in you. BJ Weinland asks, for Roland, what is your favorite memory of the cast?
I think the one thing that I remember that I probably haven't mentioned is we were a team. We were a family. We all knew we had a hard job to do, and everybody just did it. You know, there was no complaints, one exception. But he was a guy that wasn't with the series for very long, fortunately. It was kind of crabby, but people came in there. They were always positive. They were always cheerful. They were always prepared. You know, and we really liked each other. And, you know, I've been in a lot of shows where that wasn't necessarily the case, you know, that there was animosity. There was competition between performers, but this was never the case with Sailor Moon. Everybody knew we had a job to do, everybody knew what their job was, and they did it. And they did it really, really well.
Right, okay. From Pistol Pete 48, what was the recording space like? How much room did you have?
Oh, it was big.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was McClear Place Studios, which no longer exists. It's a bunch of condos now, which I think is a shame because it was a temple of creativity. Not only was Sailor Moon recorded there, but Rush, you know, many other big acts, musical acts recorded there. The studio's big, spacious. It had to be to accommodate the equipment, because we used a system called the Rhythmoband, and where your lines are projected on a screen, which is 20 feet wide and about 2 feet high. And that was above a giant television monitor, so that you could watch the scene first, and then you would watch your lines crawl across this white screen. And there's a black line at the left end of the screen, and if you pronounced every syllable as it passed over that black line, then you'd be perfectly in sync with the picture, which is another reason why we were able to do so much in such a short period of time, because the rhythm band is real fast. And there was one occasion when Terry Hawks did an entire episode nonstop from beginning to end, and she was switching from Serena to Sailor Moon and back again, and she never stopped. And, you know, we finished that whole episode with her in one take.
Really? Wow. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous. That's amazing. Okay. Jeff Tebbets asks, did you ever have any interaction with the Japanese voice actor for Melvin?
No. However, we were at a con in Toronto, and the cast of Pokemon was there. And so I went over and introduced myself to them. And, you know, we sort of compared notes about, you know, and these were actors from New York. And we compared notes about what it was like, and I was just about to leave, and one of the actresses turned to me and said, you know, when we first started to record this, the producers told us to watch Sailor Moon so we could see how this was done. And I had never been so proud of that our cast as I was at that very moment. That here are people from the Big Smoke, as Toronto is sometimes known, teaching people from the Big Apple how to do this.
Okay. Let's see here. Boris Faust asks, do you have a favorite recording of Sailor Moon Says?
I never paid much attention to Sailor Moon Says. You know, to me, I thought it was superfluous. I got the idea of, yes, we have to moralize this particular episode and teach a lesson for this particular episode. But I never really paid much regard to that. I was much more interested in the episode itself.
Yeah, you can shake your fist at Lou Scheimer and Filmation for making you do those. Okay. Greatest G asks, were there any specific restrictions or censoring given from the higher ups that had to be followed in scripting the series for US TV?
Well, we're Canadian actors,
right,
and as such, we have Canadian accents. We don't think about it much, but we do. And the Americans, because this series was largely for America, not for Canada, because it's 10 times the market, we had to disguise our Canadian pronunciations. So words like house, out, and about,
mm-hmm,
Americans somehow heard as hoos, oot, and a boot,
mm-hmm,
which is, you know, a stereotype, and we don't talk like that. Maybe on the East Coast they do, but, you know, not in the rest of Canada. So we had to, you know, use American pronunciations. So all those house, out, and about words, the OU words, we had to change to AW words, so it's house, out, and about. And sorry, the American pronunciation of that is sorry. So we had to be ever vigilant about those particular words, which would reveal that we weren't Americans.
Right. So you had to do the phonetic pronunciations on screen?
Yeah.
Okay. Huh. Similarly, Bunny Bookends asks, whose idea was it to give some characters like Luna and Molly different accents?
That would be the producer, Nicole Tuol. And, you know, what struck me, and this still puzzles me to this day, is that Molly spoke with a New York dialect, but her parents didn't. So I could never figure that out. And I'm sorry, what was the other character besides Molly?
Luna.
Luna. Well, that's Jill Frappier, and she is British. And when she was cast for the role, she was told that the character should be a mixture between Queen Victoria and C-3PO. So, and she just pumped up her British dialect, and you know, and that's why it came out the way it did.
That's interesting. That's a very interesting way to describe that. Okay. String and Sonata wants to know if you have any insight into why and how the dub names were picked. Some were close to the original names and some weren't.
Again, that was the choice of Deke.
Right.
So, you know, I don't really have any knowledge of that.
Okay. Okay. And it sounds like the answer to this question is no, but Fred J. Francis asks if there were any tensions between you and the CEO of Deke, Andy Hayward.
Well, I remember one conversation with one of the producers from Deke, and, you know, she was complaining about, you know, the number of Canadian inflections or pronunciations that were slipping through. And I tried to defend us and said, well, you know, it sounds right to Canadian ears. And she just about blew the phone off my ear when she said, this is not meant for blank Canadians. It's meant for blank Americans.
Okay.
You know, and so it was, my only response could be, okay, got it. You know, we'll look after that.
Right, right, right.
Now, there was also a conflict with Jill Frappier, Luna, when she auditioned, because she originally auditioned for one of the early episodes of the school teacher, and she had walked into the studio, and she didn't even say a word. She hadn't opened her mouth, and these two producers from Deke looked at her and said, too old, out you go. And Jill was just nonplussed by this. It's like, but I haven't even said anything yet. And she also played karaoke. So, you know, she was very used to doing, you know, younger voices and stuff. Then later on in the evening, like 1 o'clock in the morning, they realized they hadn't cast Luna yet. So they brought her back. And lo and behold, she got the role of Luna.
Okay. All right, well, we'll wrap with this question from Who Is Friend. The Sailor Moon dub really made the girls sound very distinct from each other. What influenced their performances most?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
Sure. He asks, the Sailor Moon dub really made the girls sound very distinct from each other. What influenced their performances most?
Well, originally, Sailor Mercury and Sailor Mars sounded very similar. So the instruction came to to both of them, you've got to differentiate your voices. That's one of the things about animation is, you know, when kids are watching, they're usually not looking at the screen, they're doing other things, they're playing with toys or whatever. So in order for them to follow the storyline, they have to be able to identify each character by its voice. So Karen Bernstein, who played Sailor Mercury, said, okay, well, she's a bookworm, so I'm going to make her very precise. And Sailor Mars, Katie Griffin, said, okay, I'm going to make her more aggressive. And that's what they both did. And they were able to then differentiate their voices.
Yeah, right. That's one of those things that people complain about now in anime, where, like, it's, you know, since you have the same, like, it feels like you have the same 20 people in everything, that the voices all sound kind of similar. And if you go back to that original Sailor Moon dub, you can hear, you know, these are extremely distinct sounding voices. Everybody sounds totally different. You can tell the characters apart without looking at the screen, which is unique, actually.
Yeah, no, and I think that's one of the things, even though we didn't realize we were doing it at the time, that we're very proud of. That, yeah, every character was really distinct. And that's so important in any kind of animation, to make those characters distinct. Again, for the reason that I explained before, is, you know, kids aren't necessarily looking at the screen, but they're following the story by listening. And if they don't recognize the voice, then they lose the sense of the plot or the character, and they become disinterested.
Right. Yeah, it just turns into this sort of oral morass that, you know, doesn't really mean anything. But anyway, so, well, your contributions to anime fandom in general, I don't think can be understated. Fans who are interested in picking up a copy of the book, Sailor Moon Reflections, can find it at sailormoonreflections.webs.com. And Roland, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and talking to us.
Okay, I just want to add a couple more things,
sure.
Zach. Because I just had a conversation with my publisher yesterday. I think most people are waiting for the e-read, and I just want to give them some information about where that's going to be available. It's not going to be available on Amazon.com. I don't know why, but it isn't. But the e-read will be available. It's going to be available on Kindle, Kobo, Google Books, iTunes, Nook, as well as in PDF format through up to 35,000 online retailers that have accounts with Ingram. The publisher is Friesen Press. The book is also available through the Friesen Press bookstore. If they order through our website, which you've already mentioned, they will get an autographed copy of the book. If they order through any of the other outlets, then no. Prices for the book have been set. It's $30 for the hardcover, $20 for the soft cover, and $4.99 for the e-read. As I said before, that if they go to the our website for the book, they will get an autographed copy of the book. And I really encourage them, to buy the book because I'd like to sell some.
Well,
we've got about 30 pre-orders so far. Response has been very wonderful. I suspect a lot of people are waiting for the e-read because it's the least expensive version, and everything will be there. And, it will explain in much more detail what we've been talking about today and answer many, many other questions. Plus, if anybody wants to contact me, if they go through our website, and there's a contact button there for me, and if they have any further questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Okay, well, fantastic. And once again, thanks for coming on the show.
And thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure, Zach.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Roland for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a little rating or review. We'd appreciate it. And we'll see you all next time.
Serena thinks school's a drag, but learning can be fun, and having a good education is a great way to give yourself the best start for the rest of your life. I'm going to work on Serena's study habits. How about working on yours, too, like doing homework before watching TV or reading comic books? And if you want to be alert and ready to learn, get a good night's sleep and eat the right foods. Food? Did you say food? Give school a chance. Give your future a chance.